Good evening, and thanks for coming. I'd like to thank Shari Shemayim for hosting, as well as our sponsors who you see listed on the handouts. If anyone does not have a handout, they're over there on the table next to the hot water. I'd also like to thank the Law Society of Upper Canada for approving credit for the class. I'm passing around a... you didn't know that? Yes.
Yeah, one.
1.25 professionalism credits. Yes. Sorry? Yeah, no, it's on the website.
I used it last year.
Yep. I'm passing around a sheet with spots to sign in. Please make sure that you sign in and that you include your email address so that I can follow up with you about anything that comes up tonight. In particular, I upload the audio from the session, so if you sign up, then I will be able to email you the link for the audio. This is the second time that I'm doing a CPD-approved class here in Toronto, and I'm still trying to figure out the format in terms of balance between how much time to spend on the Jewish law issues and how much time to spend on the General Law Society's rules of professional conduct and the like. So I would welcome feedback on the format. If you can follow up with me afterwards, that would be great. If you want to comment to me afterwards, that would be great as well. Inviting a group of lawyers to comment is not always safe, nonetheless. I learned that last time. So the topic for tonight is professional confidentiality and the demands of Jewish law. And there are three cases in particular I would like to address. You can see them on your sheets. If you take a look first after source number 16, so the bottom of the second side, that's the first case I hope to address. I am counsel for an individual who has been found guilty of molesting a child on three separate occasions. My client moves across the province, applies for a position as a nanny, and is accepted. Am I prohibited from, permitted to, or obligated to inform the prospective employer of her past? Leave aside the question of whether this could actually happen. In other words, is there any way that someone would hire such a person without doing an investigation? That's not the point. The question is, what are my responsibilities from the standpoint of the rules of professional conduct and from the standpoint of Jewish law? So that's the first question. The second question is found after source 18, and that is, as counsel for a public corporation, I become aware that they are moving rapidly toward filing for bankruptcy. A neighbor of mine has invested her retirement funds in corporate stock. May I inform her of the danger, which of course I only know about because of my role with the corporation? So that's the second question we'll deal with. And then the third, and in many ways the hardest question, is the one that you see at the end of your sources. As counsel in a case of medical malpractice, I've become aware that a certain cardiac surgical team has a poor track record. A neighbor is planning on using them for her heart bypass surgery. I confer with my own counsel and learn that this does not rise to the level of risk permitting disclosure. However, I believe that I'm obligated to warn her under the Jewish law requiring that I intervene to prevent harm to others, as we'll discuss. So do I inform her, in other words, where potentially Law Society rules of professional conduct are opposed to the rules that are set down in Jewish law, what do I do? So that we have a lot to deal with tonight, and you can see that by the fact that we have 16 sources to get to before we even get to the cases at hand. So this is listed as an hour and a quarter class. I will honor that, and I do expect, God willing, to get to everything within it and to still have some time for discussion. Okay, we begin with the principle of confidentiality in general. There is a principle of confidentiality in both the LSUC's rules of professional conduct and in Judaism. If you take a look at source number one on your sheet, you see from the rules of professional conduct, rule 2.03, parentheses 1. A lawyer at all times shall hold in strict confidence all information concerning the business and affairs of the client acquired in the course of the professional relationship, and shall not divulge any such information unless expressly or impliedly authorized by the client or required by law to do so. No divulging information unless either the client indicates that it's okay or the law requires it. That includes a case in which you know that a crime has been committed or is going to be committed. So take a look, please, at source number 2, where you see the commentary to the rules of professional conduct, and it says, although the rules of professional conduct make it clear that the lawyer shall not knowingly assist or encourage any dishonesty, fraud, crime, or illegal conduct, and provide a rule for how a lawyer should respond to conduct by an organization that was, is, or may be dishonest, fraudulent, criminal, or illegal, it does not follow that the lawyer should disclose to the appropriate authorities an employer's or client's proposed misconduct. Okay? So even though I am not allowed as a lawyer, by the way, I keep saying I, make sure it's clear. I'm not a lawyer. So I want to make sure that that's 100% clear. I am not posing as one. I am not giving legal advice. But if I were in a position of being a lawyer and I were to determine that there was a crime taking place, there would be rules for what I could and couldn't do. I'm not allowed to assist. I am supposed to work within the hierarchy of the company to try to prevent this from happening. I am responsible potentially, if my advice is not heeded, to actually leave, to say, okay, then I can't work for them anymore, and then there are rules about how I do that. However, that doesn't follow that I'm supposed to actually disclose to the appropriate authorities that this is going on. Rather, source 2 continues, the general rule as set out above is that the lawyer shall hold the client's information in strict confidence, and this general rule is subject to only a few exceptions, some of which we're going to see. Ed, you had a question?
No.
Okay. So even if the crime warrants that the lawyer step away, that does not mean he should tell anybody about it. Now, sometimes a lawyer is required to disclose. So take a look at source number 3. We've already hinted at this before. When required by law or by order of a tribunal of competent jurisdiction, a lawyer shall disclose confidential information. But the lawyer shall not disclose more information than is required. So sometimes you have to disclose, but even then, you have to be very careful to only disclose that which is demanded by the situation and not anything further. And more than that, take a look at number 4. The rules of professional conduct instruct you to be careful not only about what you tell, but also to whom you tell it. So it says, when a lawyer is employed or retained by an organization to act in a matter, and the lawyer knows that the organization has acted or is acting dishonestly, fraudulently, criminally, or illegally with respect to that matter, then in addition to his or her obligations under subrule 5, the lawyer for the organization shall A. advise the person from whom the lawyer takes instructions and the chief legal officer, or both the chief legal officer and the chief executive officer, that the conduct was or is dishonest, fraudulent, criminal, or illegal and should be stopped. And then B. if necessary, because the person from whom the lawyer takes instructions, the chief legal officer or the chief executive officer, refuses to cause the wrongful conduct to be stopped, advise progressively the next highest persons or groups, including ultimately the board of directors. In other words, your first responsibility is to report it to chief legal officer, or I should say, the person from whom the lawyer takes instructions and the chief legal officer, and then you work your way up within the hierarchy, but you don't go informing everybody. It's supposed to be done in a limited way. So that's the perspective from the rules of professional conduct of the LSUC. There is a principle of confidentiality. Knowing even that a crime is being committed does not necessarily warrant disclosure. Even if you are required to disclose, you have to be very careful about what you say and to whom you say it to minimize what is being disclosed. Within halakha, within Jewish law, we have a similar set of rules. Take a look at source number 5, please, a passage from the Talmud, the basis from which Jewish law is derived. making a comment here from a couple of thousand years ago. The Talmud asks, Minayim la'omer davar l'chaveiro, shehu bebal yomar, ad sheyomar lo, lech emor. How do we know that if party A tells something to party B is not allowed to relate it to others unless the person says, go tell it? How do I know? This is not about lawyers. This is a general statement. How do I know that I am not allowed to repeat that which somebody tells me without permission? Shenamar, because the biblical verse says, Vayidaber Hashem Elav Me'o Hel Moed Lemor. When God speaks to Moses in the Torah, he generally concludes his sentence by saying, Lemor, go tell this. In other words, it says often, Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe Lemor. In this verse, it says, Vayidaber Hashem Elav Me'o Hel Moed Lemor. And God spoke to him, Moses, from the tent of meeting. And he said, go tell this to the people. From the fact that Moses needs a specific divine instruction that says, go tell this, that indicates the conversations are by default private, unless unless you are explicitly told, go tell this. This is the requirement of confidentiality. There are other verses and sources that mirror this. I brought one in the interests of time. However, there are times when you're obligated to disclose, just like you had that responsibility to disclose under the rules of professional conduct where it's demanded by a tribunal of competent jurisdiction. So take a look at source number 6. Maimonides, writing in the 12th century, in the Laws of Oaths, discusses a case in which a person swears an oath saying that he is not going to testify. Now, what Maimonides bases his comments on is that there is a biblical obligation to testify if you know testimony regarding a case. So this person has sworn he's not going to, but he has a biblical obligation to testify. So what does he do? So Maimonides writes, Hanish bala chaveiro, shelo a'id lecha edus zu shani yodah, o shelo a'id lecha emei dalecha edus, one who swears to another person saying, I won't offer the testimony I possess, or if I do know any testimony, I'm not going to say it. Hareza lo kemishim shvuas shav. First of all, he has sworn an oath in vain, and he'll be punished for that, and the reason is because he has sworn to violate his obligation to testify. So taking an oath saying, I will break my obligation to testify, is called a vain oath. Now, under what circumstances and what sort of penalties, those are a great discussion, but not for right now. The point is, the oath is considered to be an oath in vain. Why? Because he is commanded to testify. This is not optional. When the tribunal demands that you testify, you're obligated to testify. An interesting parallel between the Law Society's rules of professional conduct and what we see within the Torah's rules. However, we also have a limitation. I didn't bring it here on the sheet because the discussion of it is rather extensive. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, in his Chafetz Chaim work on the laws of guarding one's speech and making sure to speak properly, discusses it at length. The rule is that even when one is supposed to tell, one has to be very, very limited in what is said and how is said. So he discusses a classic case. There is a young man who is dating a young woman, and the young woman doesn't know something about the young man's past. You feel like if she knew this, she wouldn't want to go ahead with the marriage. So you, being a good person, want to disclose that information to her. There are all sorts of rules. First of all, there's a discussion, before we get into where the LSUC discusses, there's a discussion of motivation, of making sure that you are not an interested party in some way, and that could be biasing your decision. Then after that, there's a question of, so what exactly are you going to say? Making sure you don't color it, making sure you don't say more than needs to be said, and to whom you're going to disclose it, and watching out for the potential fallout of what is said and how is said and to whom it is said. There are grave concerns regarding this issue. So we see you have a similar structure in terms of the practice of law, and in terms of what the halacha, what Jewish law requires in terms of confidentiality. Where does confidentiality come from? Why is it that we have this expectation of confidentiality? Yes, Mark.
Before you get there, in terms of halacha, I mean, the mitzvah seems to be in general. There's no. Is there a higher duty to certain, let's say, to a rabbi that hears things from somebody in strict confidence, or I know there's no such
right.
thing as a lawyer specifically, but is there people that have a higher degree of
good question.
Confidentiality,
right?
Similar to a lawyer,
right?
There?
And the answer is yes, sort of. It's not as always. They not that you. I may not be a lawyer, but I know how to say sort of. The answer is that yes, but not because of his position as a rabbi, but rather because of our need to understand what the expectations are of the person who discloses it, meaning. I already told you in source number 5 that you can't say something unless the person tells you to say it. However, when you get to practical cases, there is an understanding that in certain cases, information is meant to be shared. So, for example, someone tells you, Mazel Tov, my daughter is engaged. Right? So, depending on their relationship with you, that will likely determine whether they meant, don't tell anybody, my daughter's engaged, it's not public knowledge yet, or whether they're now telling the world that she's now engaged, and therefore there's nothing wrong with you emailing your 100 closest friends to say, did you hear the news? Right? Or similarly, when it's bad news, right? When someone passes away, often people actually want that information told, and there we have to a certain extent, mind read, to the minimal extent possible, and understand what is expected of us. So you talk about the case of a rabbi and a congregant, or a lawyer and a client. If a person comes by information in an environment in which it's logical to assume that the person wanted it kept in confidence, he's going to be under a strict obligation to do so. That would be what I would say. Okay. So where does confidentiality come from? Why do we have this emphasis upon confidentiality in our systems of law? What would you say? Sorry? A privacy act? Actually, doesn't seem like it. If you take a look at... Well, before I get to source number 7, there is, within the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, in Section 8, there is a protection from search and seizure which unreasonably invades privacy. But that's fairly limited in its scope. There also is a new tort under development in Ontario over the last couple of years regarding what's called intrusion upon seclusion. The idea that people like their privacy and you can't invade it. If you take a look at source number 7, I brought one piece. There are many articles. You can find them online just as easily as I can, or more easily, from Jared Mackey, Privacy and the Canadian Media. With the recent recognition of the new tort of intrusion upon seclusion, Canadian privacy law has experienced a fundamental and modernizing shift. In Jones v. I don't know how this is pronounced. I'm guessing Tige, but I don't know. The Ontario Court of Appeal held that a person is liable for an invasion of privacy if, quote, he or she intrudes physically or otherwise upon the seclusion of another or his private affairs or concerns if the invasion would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. Highly offensive to a reasonable person. So, obviously, the courts have to figure out what that means. But there is this idea of protecting privacy, and it's something that's existed in the United States for a very long time, for a century. This idea of protecting a person's privacy is considered in general to be recognition of an evolving need in society, which comes about not only because people want their privacy more, but because there are more and better mechanisms for invading it. Okay? There was a time when, if someone would know my private information, right, you couldn't really get to it unless I was foolish about the way that I conveyed it. Right? If I went and said something in a public space, or if I wrote something and I wasn't careful about where I had written it down, you could always have cases in which someone invaded privacy, but it was harder to do. Today, unfortunately, with digital information, with greater means of spying on others through technology, and and with an incentive for it in the media. And that's what he discusses in particular in this, in the piece I quoted at source number 7, but it's true in general. There is a greater invasion of privacy, and therefore there is greater concern for that invasion. And this is before we get into government wiretaps and everything else, talking about just between citizens. So that's the way it's looked at in secular law, is that people want to have their information kept private. And even before this new tort of intrusion upon seclusion, there was an understanding that if someone said something to a lawyer, it should be protected for an additional reason, which we'll get to. In other words, there's an extra reason when it comes to lawyers. I'm going to come back to that. In halacha, in Jewish law, privacy is valued both in terms of protecting other individuals and in terms of protecting society. Flip the page, please, to source number 8. Here's an example of valuing privacy in terms of protecting the individual. This is a principle known in Talmudic language as hezek ri'ya, or damage caused by seeing. And what this means is that I am not allowed, under Jewish law, I am not allowed to build on my property in such a way that I will be able to see into somebody else's property. It's a zoning law, right? If I add a floor to my house, and as a result I have a view into their backyard, I am violating this law of hezek ri'ya, damaging via sight. Why? Take a look at source number 8. Rabbi Yehoshua Falk, writing in 16th century Poland, but the law he's explaining dates back to the Talmud a couple of thousand years ago. Mishum, he says, Disham ha-ra'iya mitzad asma ein osa bohen hezek ela shegoremes hezek. He's referring to a discussion in the Code of Jewish Law. You see, section 154.3. And he says there, seeing the property doesn't itself harm anything, but it causes harm. Kigon shechavero lo yaseh asakav bechatzer mikarach habusha mimenu, because the other person, the person who is being observed or thinks he may be observed, says, well, now I can't use my yard to do the things I wanted to do because this person can see me. So you are limiting his use of the property by virtue of your ability to see in. So we understand that people want their privacy as individuals, and further, it's understood that confidentiality also protects society. If you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Aharon Halevi was the anonymous author of the work Sefer HaChinuch. I've outed him here this evening. It was written anonymously originally, but scholars tend to think that he was the author. Sefer HaChinuch is a book that records all of the commandments of the Torah and numbers them, and offers a brief explanation of each of them. So on mitzvah number 236, he writes, this is regarding the mitzvah of rechilut, the prohibition against talebearing, against gossip. He says, Misharshei ha-mitzvah, among the roots of this command, ki Hashem chafetz b'tovas habrios asher bara, is that God desires the good of His creations. V'tzivanu bazek de'lios shalom beinenu ki arachilus siba lariv umatza. He says, God instructed us regarding this, regarding privacy, regarding not gossiping, so that there would be peace among us. Because gossip causes quarreling and strife. It's not only about the damage you do to the individual whose secret is divulged, it's also the fact that it's going to cause quarrels between people. In fact, Judaism goes even further than that in its valuing of privacy and views it as a religious value. If you're familiar with the term tzniut, right? Tzniut means privacy. That's what the term at its core means. It gets used in all sorts of other ways, but at its core, the word lahatznia is to put something away in a space that's designated for it, and to be tsanua is to be somebody who is private in their conduct. Tzniut is privacy, and take a look at source number 10. It is a verse from Tanakh, from Scripture, from the book of Micha, perhaps the clearest presentation of it biblically, although there are others. Higid lecha adam matov. Micha the prophet addresses the Jewish people and he says, He, God, has told you, man, what is good. Uma Hashem doresh mimcha. And what does God require of you? Ki emasot mishpat, but to practice justice. Ve'avat chesed, to love kindness. Ve'atznei alechet im elokecha, and walk privately with your God. He says, those are your three obligations in life. Do justice, love kindness, and walk privately with your God. That's his digest. So this idea of being private is considered meritorious. It's considered a religious value. So we've seen roots of it in terms of protecting one's privacy, because people want their privacy protected within the within secular law. We've seen it as a religious value within Jewish law, as well as a practical value. But there's another element when you get to lawyers, which I'm going to get to in a moment. But before I do that, I have to offer a disclaimer. I'm sure all the lawyers present know that separate from the issue of confidentiality, there is also a separate principle of solicitor-client privilege, right? Which a litigant is able to claim in order to avoid disclosing certain information, including that which is part of solicitor-client communications. Take a look, please, at source number 11, a document from the Law Society's website. Though the term privilege is often used to refer to a lawyer's duty of confidentiality, the duty of confidentiality must be distinguished from solicitor-client privilege. Privilege is an evidentiary rule of law that refers to the legal right of an individual to withhold information from an opposing party, a court, a tribunal, and investigations, including law enforcement officials. In other words, confidentiality is a burden upon the lawyer. It's the lawyer's responsibility not to divulge whatever he learns, other than in certain unique circumstances. Privilege is what the litigant will claim in court when he doesn't want to, or not necessarily in a courtroom, but the idea that there's something that the litigant can say to protect himself and avoid having to divulge information. They're really two separate things. And I want to focus on confidentiality specifically for three reasons. Number one, confidentiality is a broader ethical issue. Privilege is more technical when you have to figure out what counts as solicitor-client communication. Not everything that a lawyer and a client convey to each other counts as solicitor-client communication. When what the tribunal can demand to be disclosed, what they can't demand. So number one, privilege is more technical. Number two, confidentiality is, as I said, the lawyer's burden. Privilege is the client's option. So I'd like to deal with the lawyer's personal decision of whether to reveal information in order to save someone else from harm, as we talked about in the presentation of the cases. And then third, confidentiality has a presence in both the rules of the LSUC and in Jewish law. Privilege has no analog in Jewish law, of which I am aware, as Morris noted before. There is no position of lawyer officially in the judicial system set up by the Torah. There can be people who present things, and there are, but there's no special standing. And so the whole idea of solicitor-client privilege is really, as I had said before, just a function of the fact that there was a communication which clearly was meant to be private. There's nothing more explicit than that within Jewish law. So what I'm really looking to discuss is the broader confidentiality obligation for the lawyer, as opposed to the litigant's ability to keep things to himself. We clear? I've been talking a lot. If anyone has any questions, or please jump in. Okay. Then we go to one more step here, which is the special roots of confidentiality regarding solicitor-client relationship. And this, by the way, is not only true for solicitor-client, but it will apply, for example, with doctor-patient. The same principle will apply. In Canadian law, it's really about the ability of the lawyer and the client to build a relationship. We sacrifice the benefit of public information, even accepting that it may cause harm, in order to enable a functional judicial system. Take a look at source number 12, please. Commentary to the Rules of Professional Conduct. A lawyer cannot render effective professional service to the client unless there is full and unreserved communication between them. Right? It makes sense. If the client is constantly worrying, where is this going? How is he going to say anything? Ditto for the patient with the doctor. At the same time, the client must feel completely secure and entitled to proceed on the basis that, without any express request or stipulation on the client's part, matters disclosed to or discussed with the lawyer will be held in strict confidence. The client should not need to say, this is just between us. It has to be a given in the relationship. That's in Canadian law. Now, since Jewish law does not have this formal lawyer position, it's not surprising you won't have a direct parallel, but we do have one. Rabbi Alfred Cohn wrote an article a little over 30 years ago in a journal called the Journal of Halakha and Contemporary Society, it's the first volume, in which he noted that we do have a parallel principle of protecting protecting society at the expense of the individual. In this case, with confidentiality, we are protecting society, we're protecting the judicial system at the expense of a particular person who would have benefited from knowing this information. That's the way that we're looking at this. So too, within Jewish law, he pointed to source number 13, which is based on a passage in the Talmud, but 13 was a simpler presentation, and so I use this. It's Maimonides in his code of law, based on the Talmud, discussing the case in which people have been taken hostage, and they're being held for ransom. Unfortunately, not a rare occurrence in Talmudic times. And so, the question was, are you allowed to ransom them? Well, you say, well, why not? Of course I can ransom them. And the answer is, there's a risk when you ransom them. What's the risk? Right. You encourage them to do it again. Exactly. So in source number 13, we are told, Ein podin es hashvuyim b'yeser al d'mehen mipnei tikkun ha'olam. We don't redeem captives for more than their value. How you determine what their value is a really good question. But we don't redeem them for more than their value. Why? For society's sake. The phrase in the Hebrew, tikkun ha'olam. Shalo yehiyu ha'ayvim rot fin achareihem lishvosam. Lest the enemy pursue them to capture them. You're going to encourage them. Now, the person who's being held for ransom says, save me. Help me out. But society has to say, if we negotiate with the terrorists, in the event that we ransom them, then we're just emboldening them and they're going to do more next time. And therefore, Maimonides argues, we don't ransom them for more than their value. Now, the truth of the matter is there are exceptions to this rule. For example, one is allowed to ransom oneself, disregarding this rule, no matter what the price is, also a husband for his wife. There are longer discussions about how this works in practice. But the fundamental principle, as noted by Rabbi Cohn, is that we are protecting society at the expense of the individual. It's not always so clear-cut. For example, there are responses that deal with the POW question. What if it's not just anybody who was taken hostage, but it was a soldier who was taken hostage, maybe on the battlefield? There is an imperative to protect society by specifically ransoming him. Because if your soldiers are afraid that when they go out to battle, you're going to abandon them, then they are less likely to take risks on the battlefield. So therefore, actually protecting society may involve ransoming them. It's a much more complicated topic. But the point is that we have a parallel concept of protecting society at the expense of the individual, in this case, protecting the judicial system and the concept of confidentiality at the expense of the individual who would have benefited by knowing the truth. So far, so good? Okay. There's a flip side, because otherwise this would be a half-hour lecture. The flip side is that we have, within Jewish law and within general ethics, a duty of rescue. Now, the truth of the matter is that even though there's a general duty of rescue in society's ethos, meaning that if you ask your random person, you see somebody drowning in a river, you know how to swim, do you jump in and save them? Or you know how to apply CPR. You see somebody who is struggling to, give the situation whatever you want for the situation. Do you intervene? Generally speaking, people's answer will be yes. However, in Ontario law, there is no duty to rescue. There's protection for the Good Samaritan who does, but there is no formal duty to rescue unless one of two things is true. Either if I created the danger, so then I'm obligated to try to save the person, or if I have a special relationship with the victim such that the victim has reason to expect that I would intervene. Those are two exceptions to the rule. But in general, there's no duty to rescue. I asked a lawyer friend of mine, who I think is listening to the audio, I asked him what the logic was in not having a duty to rescue if it's always recognized as ethically important. So he offered me two suggestions. Number one, because you have people who don't know how to rescue, and if you create a duty to rescue, now they're going to be bound to act when they don't know what they're doing, and potentially could cause more harm than good. That was number one. And then number two, he said, was the concern for lawsuits that may result when somebody who was forced to rescue now is going to be held responsible for the consequences, Good Samaritan laws notwithstanding. And in truth, within Judaism, we have a legal protection for those who intervene because they were forced to rescue, and now you can't tell me that they're going to be held responsible for what they did. We discussed that in a class here not long ago, the class for doctors. But the point is that in Ontario law, you do not have a formal duty to rescue, barring where you created the danger or you have a special relationship with the person in danger. In contrast, Judaism recognizes a very strong responsibility for rescue, which is going to affect the way Jewish law looks at breaching confidentiality. Take a look, please, at source 14. This is a midrash. This goes back also to Talmudic times and even a little bit earlier. Rabbinic commentary to biblical verses. There's a biblical verse which states, "V'lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol." Do not place a stumbling block before the blind. And this means, "Lifnei suma b'davar," before someone who is blind in a given matter. In other words, it's not to be understood literally as if there's someone who is blind walking along, don't put something in front of him. While that's true, it's not the limit of my responsibility. When someone is blind, we understand that to mean not only literally so, but we also understand that to mean somebody who is not aware. So if someone is unaware of the issues involved in a particular matter, you have a responsibility not to cause him to stumble. If he's taking advice from you, don't give him advice which is inappropriate for him. Now there, that sounds like you'd only be violating that if you actively gave bad advice. What about inaction? So number one, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, a contemporary authority in Jewish law, writing on this in his Chelkas Yaakov work of Responsa, contends that this applies even with inaction. If I fail to act, I've also violated this. But in any case, we have another instruction which is more explicit. Take a look at source number 15. A passage from the Talmud. Minayin l'ro'es chaveroshu toveya banahar ochaya gorarto olistin bayin alav. How do you know that if you see somebody drowning, or you see someone being dragged by a beast, or you see someone beset by bandits, how do you know shuchayav lahatzilo, that you're obligated to act and save him? Talmud Lamar, the Torah says, lo sa'amod al dam re'echa, you shall not stand by the blood of your peer. So here we have an explicit obligation to intervene. Now, there are differences between the two, even though I've already said that I believe that the prohibition against putting a stumbling block before the blind applies even in a case of inaction. There still are certain differences between the two. I'm not going to go into it at length. I'm not going to go into it. There are certain technical differences. One thing I did want to note, though, because this is always asked of me, is the question of, does this apply to everybody? Meaning, is this somehow a Jewish-specific law? And the answer is no. It applies to Jews and to non-Jews alike. I brought you source number 16 regarding putting a stumbling block before the blind. This is the most straightforward presentation of the law. Amar Rabbi Natan, Rabbi Natan said in the Talmud, Minayin shelo yoshit adam kos shel yayin lenazir. A nazir, or Nazirite, is somebody who has taken a vow that he's not going to do certain things. Among them, he's not going to drink wine. So how do I know that I'm not allowed to give him a cup of wine? That's one example. And second example, the Torah includes seven laws that are called Noahide laws, that are laws for all human beings, not only for Jews. And one of them prohibits eating flesh taken from an animal before the animal was dead. It's a longer discussion as to why, what's going on there. It's a great discussion for another time. But it's one of the prohibitions that applies to all human beings. So how do I know that I'm not allowed to give such a piece of flesh to someone who isn't Jewish, to a Noahide? And they quote our verse, "V'lifnei iver lo sitein michshol," do not put a stumbling block before the blind. So you see the prohibition against letting somebody stumble is not only regarding Jews, but it's regarding everybody. Okay, so now what we've seen, to summarize, is number one, confidentiality exists as a legal force in both general law and Jewish law, and even where it is overridden, it must still be honored to the extent possible. Number one. Number two, secular society recognizes a special imperative for confidentiality between lawyers and clients in order to protect society's legal system. That does not exist directly in Judaism, but the concept of protecting society at the expense of individuals does exist. And then finally, when it comes to the duty to intervene and rescue somebody, Judaism recognizes such a duty while society does not have it enshrined in law. Clear so far? Okay. That brings us to our cases. The first case again. I am counsel for an individual who has been found guilty of molesting a child on three separate occasions. My client moves across the province, applies for a position as a nanny, and is accepted. Am I prohibited from, permitted to, or obligated to inform the prospective employer of her past? Under Ontario law, what would you say? Or the Law Society's rules, I should say. What would you say?
You're missing a key fact here.
Yeah, which is?
Child and Family Services Act.
Yeah.
The obligation to inform with respect to the child needs to be the obligation to inform ourselves to the authorities, not to the prospective employer.
And the abuse has already occurred and the authorities are well aware. Right now, this is a question of warning about what I think is going to happen.
Another child, it's highly likely another child is going to be abused. You have an obligation, in my view, family law is my area.
Okay.
I have an obligation to tell the children's name.
So Yechiel suggests...
But I would go and get an opinion from Phil Epstein first.
Suggest that you get an opinion on this matter. But there could be a responsibility to report to authorities in the case in which you became aware that someone with a history like this was going to be entrusted with a child. That's what you're suggesting. Separate from the confidentiality issue of, do I tell the parent, there's that possibility.
It's statutory, and you might be guilty of a quasi-criminal offense for not reporting.
Got it. Okay. Yes?
So that is one of the exceptions, that if there's a duty to report, but barring the duty to report, what you might do is, rather than disclose, say, you know, it's not a bad idea if you do a criminal background check.
Right. Right, so this is a classic way to deal with the problem if you're dealing with a situation in which you're not supposed to disclose, but you feel some kind of ethical imperative, is to try to say something which will lead them to do their own digging, and they'll find whatever they find, and you didn't tip them off in any direct way. I don't know where that fits in terms of the Law Society and how they would look at it. So I'm not recommending anything, but that's something that I know people do when they're faced with this sort of a situation. Marth, you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the fact that they're found guilty and assuming that their name has not been withheld, I mean, the details of the conviction would be in the public realm and wouldn't necessarily have been acquired by means of assistance. Relationship.
Right. So that's a flaw in my case.
It's not a question of somebody being charged and not convicted yet. There is the language that says that they didn't convict them.
Right. No, and that's true. The information is out there in the public domain. And maybe the answer would be to make sure someone else gets a hold of that information so that I'm not accused in any way of divulging that, which I know because of my confidential relationship. I'm not sure how that works with a lawyer conveying information which is publicly known. It wasn't from the relationship.
I'm not sure I've been disclosed. Like, this rule is really broad, right? You hold in strict confidence all information concerning the business affairs of the client. I think to disclose, you need some reasonable probability. I get that there's three prior findings of guilt, right? But, you know, a criminal trial is not a statistic. Like, how do you know it's going to happen?
Right.
I think you need really good evidence that this is going to happen. You've got a pretty strong...
Right.
I don't know, I would seek advice, and if I had to, I'd probably retain another lawyer and instruct them to go do it. My confidentiality.
Right. There you go. Jerry.
Would any normal person, the child, who knew that they had three previous convictions, hire such a...
Well, this person doesn't know. They moved across the province.
So it's clear that this is something that... this person, if there's something wrong with this person, if he doesn't check it out, if there's, you're sort of helping him or her in a stupidity, if you will.
Right.
But the societal duty is, you know, that anyone would not hire this person. It's, I don't think there's anyone who would hire such a person.
Well, I'll tell you what. I would hope that you're right, but take a look at source 17, please, the top of the third side. Because I believe that under the rules of professional conduct, one would be entitled to tell. Where a lawyer believes upon reasonable grounds that there is an imminent risk to an identifiable person or group of death or serious bodily harm, including serious psychological harm that substantially interferes with health or well-being, the lawyer may disclose, pursuant to judicial order where practicable, confidential information where it is necessary to do so in order to prevent the death or harm, but shall not disclose more information than is required. Once again, you get that limitation of be careful about how much you divulge. But we're told here that the lawyer is indeed allowed to disclose. Now, the truth of the matter is, when I read this, I had a hard time understanding this. Here's my problem. If there's no duty to rescue, why is the lawyer allowed to breach a duty of confidentiality? In other words, here I have an obligation. Keep this confidential. On the other hand, the ability to save someone, but no obligation to. So why are you allowing me to breach confidentiality? And I offer the following suggestion. One possibility is, I consulted with lawyer friends on this, and it's a hard topic, but one possibility is that it's because it's impossible to envision a society in which the lawyer can't do this. In other words, to envision a society that's going to say, you know that someone's going to hire a nanny with three convictions for molestation and that you have to keep your mouth closed, is a very, very difficult thing to imagine. That's one possible explanation. Therefore, the wording is may. It's not must disclose. It's may disclose in source 17. Alternatively, perhaps... it's not an obligation, and this really goes, I think it maybe goes hand in hand with what I just said, actually. It's not so different. But it's not an obligation, but it's permission so as not to create a situation in which lawyers who feel morally obligated have their hands tied. That's one possibility to explain this. The other thing that's interesting here to me is the wording of an identifiable person or group. You have to be able to pinpoint. Why is it only for someone who is identifiable? Yeah, Leia.
Well, in the case where you have somebody who's threatening a particular person, then you know you have the identifiable threat against that person. But if you have a client who's just generally violent, and it's your job to represent them, you can't warn everybody.
Well, this...
And you can't have them locked up for it.
Well,
yeah. One that comes up in my practice, and it's come up enough times in the past year that I really need to ask my firm to develop a policy on it, is clients who are threatening suicide. You know, we know that we may disclose it to somebody, but who are we going to call? What are we going to do about it? Because, as I say, it happens with a certain degree of regularity.
Right, at least there's an identifiable person, though.
Right, we know who they're threatening to harm. Usually it's themselves.
Right. What's the area of your practice? Okay.
I'm gonna move back to the topic just because while it's interesting, that can go a long way in other directions. But this case comes up. I'll give you a case which I found. A woman received the HIV virus from a tainted blood transfusion. She then had a boyfriend later on, and she transmitted it to her boyfriend 5 years later. He sued the hospital. The hospital claimed there is no duty to an unidentifiable third party. Right? How are we going to notify everybody? Do we have to publish a list of people who, you know, who we have discovered are HIV positive? Right? I mean, this is a hard thing to imagine. On the other hand, another case that came up was a case of a therapist whose client was violent and was threatening harm to people of a certain kind. And I'm not being specific because I don't remember all the specifics of the case right now. I saw it quite a ways back. But the argument from the court was actually the therapist was responsible to warn authorities about this threat against a group of people, even though it wasn't like an identifiable group. It was more a class, and it wasn't. It certainly wasn't a specific individual. So why is it only for an identifiable person?
Because you're breaching the confidentiality of the other person. Like that example, the hospital can't just publish everyone's HIV positive. It violates their privacy.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Paint a whole class of people.
Well, it's the other way around. In other words, they are a threat to a group of people. It's not... So a few possibilities. One possibility is that there's less of a duty to anonymous people. Whatever responsibility there is really to particular person, not to people you don't not only do not know, but cannot know. There isn't a particular target. That's number one. Number two, and this is noted in a case, Chandler Smith v. Jones, that encouraging this would, number one, make practice impossible, realistically, and number two, make confidential relationships impossible. It's just too broad, right? You're going to require now that every time I think my client is a threat to anybody, I'm now going to have to notify them. It's going to kill the possibility of confidential relationships. Another possibility is that it's also too broad a slippery slope, or that's mixing metaphors. But it's too slippery a slope, right? You're going to now say that when you think there's a harm to someone, you can't really pinpoint whom, and you don't know exactly how, but you have to let everybody know about it. It's just it is too slippery a slope. So from it, yes.
Sorry, but if we go back to the case study in 16,
yeah.
I think that you're making certain assumptions and you changed these assumptions and it changes the result. So maybe this person was convicted three times and maybe the last conviction was 30 years ago and they've gotten their life in order since they thought they're on the right drugs with the right treatment. But they were found out and now they're being chased out of town and moved across the province and getting a new job. But they've been clean for 30 years. Do you disclose that and ruin their chances to make their life?
Good point. Good point. And that's the weakness of every vignette, is that there are holes like that.
So the issue really is what constitutes reasonable grounds and how do you assess the event of risk.
Right.
Right. And your point is really given the length of time, or
right.
The question.
Length of time and activities. The fact that they've gone through some form of rehabilitation.
Right. But even if it was a shorter period of time, there might be other circumstances, like this person might not be alone, they're currently under, it's a close supervised environment, they're under extensive treatment, there might be other mitigating factors that would go to what's reasonable and what's imminent. Right.
It's a hard case, and yes, to be specific enough would require a real case, really. That's what it would need. I don't know in Canada. In the US, yes.
Is there one in Canada?
Yes.
Everything else.
True. From the standpoint of Jewish law, one would not only have a may tell, but one would have a must tell. Again, assuming that there wasn't reason to think that the person had been rehabilitated in between, but there would be a must tell obligation, and if one was in doubt, one would be obligated to consult experts in order to determine the nature of the situation in terms of whether it's warranted or not. Because again, we have this duty to rescue. So take a look at source number 18. This comes from Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, dealing with a doctor who has a patient who is epileptic. And the patient wants to get a driver's license and not disclose to the authorities that he's vulnerable to seizure. So Rabbi Waldenberg writes, Ubevadai habarur shemutar vegam chayav limsor machlato l'shiltonut. He says it is of the greatest certainty one is permitted and also obligated to inform the authorities of this person's illness. You have a duty, and there it's not to a particular individual, an identified person. It's to society as a whole. Anyone who's going to be on the street when this person gets behind the wheel. We have similar rulings in Jewish law. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach discussed the case of a doctor whose patient is HIV positive and the question of notifying the patient's spouse. These cases come up. So within Jewish law, it's a must under these circumstances. I want to move to case number two. Case number two is a case of financial harm. As counsel for a public corporation, I become aware that they are moving rapidly toward filing for bankruptcy. A neighbor of mine has invested her retirement funds in corporate stock. May I inform her of the danger? Now it's financial harm. Based on what we saw in source number 17, we already know, so I'm not going to put the question out there, this is not in the realm of death or serious bodily harm or serious psychological harm. I suppose one could make the case for a Madoff type of situation where somebody has actually done away with a person's entire retirement funds and the person is in their 70s or 80s and now they're stuck. Maybe one could make a case in there. I don't know how that would be treated. But in general, financial injury is not considered grounds for revealing information. In American states, it actually is implemented as an exception for confidentiality rules. It came about, I understand, because of the Enron case and the avalanche of corporate impropriety that became public. So they said, okay, fine, financial injury also counts as an exception. It was actually floated in Ontario as early as the year 2000 and again later on. Take a look, please, at source number 19. From a special convocation which discussed changes to the rules of professional conduct, where this was what they wanted to include, one of several rules they wanted to include. Where a lawyer has reasonable grounds for believing that there is imminent risk that a fraud that may cause substantial financial injury to another is likely to be committed, the lawyer may disclose confidential information to prevent the fraud, but shall not disclose more information than is required. So they wanted to, someone wanted to add this, but it was voted down. So the lawyer is not supposed to inform to help someone avoid financial injury. Now, there is an exception to this once again. The exception is where the lawyer himself enabled the fraud, because now he was himself a cause for the harm. So that will be different. I'm also told that there is a... Under Ontario law. I'm also told that there is an exception when dealing with money laundering, but I'm not clear on the specifics of how that works. So I'm just noting that I was told that by a lawyer, but I don't have any sources to work with to support that. Yes?
The problem is the fact scenario you provide is a public corporation. Under the Securities Act, I know there's a definite prohibition from, as an insider of the corporation, from revealing...
Correct.
Public corporate information, not to the public, you're not disclosing to the public, you're disclosing to a specific individual.
Right. So I'm going to have to get to that in case three. In other words, because Jewish law may end up requiring me to divulge, in which case I would be in trouble.
As a private corporation, there would be a different...
Oh, no, but I want the opposition. But yes, you're right. That is true.
It's also a caveat emptor on the other side here, that... when you go into the stock market, you're
right. So Jerry takes me into my next question, which is, why would we distinguish between death, bodily harm, psychological harm, on the one hand, and financial injury on the other? And one answer is the answer that Jerry offers. I gave you two links in source number 20, which discuss possible justifications for including or not including. But one answer is that that it's the cost of doing business, and everybody recognizes that. That when you invest, you know that you could lose your money, and there's information you won't have access to until the general public has access to it. And that's just the way it goes. So that's one possible justification for viewing this differently. Another justification that's offered is that it's not a lawyer's role. the lawyer does have certain jobs within the company in terms of making sure that everything that they do within his purview is on the up and up. But the lawyer does not have a responsibility to protect the shareholders from damage done because the company went bankrupt. So that's a second explanation. Third is the slippery slope possibility. So let's say you justify bankruptcy, informing them about bankruptcy, right? So what's next? You know, when the company's earnings report is coming out and you know they're going to miss their earnings mark. So does that justify that I tell? It's a very hard slope to work with. Once you're going to justify for financial injury, death is a lot more clear-cut than financial injury, at least for the purposes of this class. We'll have a separate discussion at some point about time of death, but that's not within this. Rita?
A question about if you're working for a company and you know that they're going to declare bankruptcy, are you obligated to maintain that confidentiality to your client? If you divulge that, can they do these things by your client?
Oh, potentially. I mean, we already said Ontario isn't going to, the LSUC is not going to allow you to divulge.
So the counsel could be sued.
I'm getting to that. Don't worry. Another reason that's offered for why we distinguish is that it would make the practice of law impossible. Meaning, anytime you work with a corporation, this can come up. Are you now going to go around telling all the people you know every time a client of yours is having financial trouble? It becomes unreasonable in terms of the practice of law. Within Jewish law, it's trickier, and the reason why it's trickier is because you have again this duty to rescue. Take a look, please, at source number 21. Source number 21, Maimonides, in his Book of Mitzvot, where he collects the commandments, in his prohibition number 297, says, "V'amitzvah haresh tarizayim, the 297th command, he shehizhiranu mehisrashel b'hatzalas nefesh echad miyisrael kishenireyu b'sakanas hamaves or hafseid, v'yiyelanu yecholas la'atzilo." He says, this command warns us not to be weak in saving a Jew when we see he is in danger of death or loss and we are capable of rescue. The note regarding a Jew I already discussed before about the non-Jew under the separate law of Lifnei Iver, not to allow him to stumble. He's dealing here with a separate law of Lo Sa'amod, not standing by. But the point is that here he seems to say, when a person is in danger of death or loss, that would seem to include financial injury. On the other hand, Maimonides has a separate codification in his Mishneh Torah, which is his code of law, Hilchos Rotzeach, the laws of murder, and there he only lists cases that appear to be of physical harm and death. So there's an apparent contradiction, and indeed, some, Rabbi Meir Simcha HaKohen of Divinsk, a great authority in Jewish law from 100 years ago, some say that indeed what you see in number 21 is a mistake. That in fact the obligation to rescue does not extend to financial harm. However, others disagree. Minchat Chinuch is one of them. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, is another one who say that is not so. That indeed, the prohibition against standing by the blood of another includes financial loss. Well, in that case, does that now mean I'm obligated to go tell people? So maybe not, for a few reasons. Number one, Rabbi Alfred Cohn, in the article that I referred to earlier, notes that I'm harming society by damaging confidentiality. And we go back to our point that you protect society even at the expense of the individual. So he argues that even though my personal obligation normally is to save others, that may not warrant violating society's need for confidentiality. That's number one. Number two, it may be argued, akin to what Jerry wanted to note before, that people who invest in a company do so with the understanding that they may lose their funds, and that no special information should be given to them in violation of corporate rules. It's sort of like the laws that govern other financial relationships. When you deal with negotiations between parties, right? I'm on one side of the table, someone else is on the other side of the table. There are certain things I have to disclose to them. There are other things that I do not have any obligation to disclose, and if I disclose them, I'm going to harm my position. So It's an adversarial relationship, and everybody knows that the other side of the table isn't saying certain things. I have no obligation under "do not stand by the blood of your brother." I'm under no obligation to tell him things that are going to harm my position. It's understood. And the same thing is true when you're dealing with this situation of investment in a corporation. They know that they're not going to get information before everybody else does. A third reason why I may be justified in not telling is that by telling them, I am setting them up to do something illegal. Because what happens after I convey this information to them, right? What are they going to do? They're going to sell. That's called trading on inside information. Right? It may violate other laws within Jewish law as well. The onah, perhaps, if I'm selling something at more than it is worth, because right now their stock is worth far less than what they're going to get for it. There are all sorts of rules that they are violating by selling on the basis of this news. Not to mention, they're violating the principle of dina demachusa dina, that the law of the land is the law, and the law of the land prohibits them from selling on inside information. So therefore, by informing them, I'm actually doing them a disservice, because I am leading them into something they shouldn't be doing. And then one last point, which is very, very important for this and for the next case. If you take a look at source number 22, it's a passage in the Talmud. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says, quoting Rav, Amar Kra, Efes, ki lo yiyeh b'cha evyon. When the Torah presents its mitzvah of tzedakah, of philanthropy, the Torah says, but there shall be no pauper among you. Usually the emphasis is on the word among, the way I just read it. However, the Talmud picks up on the word you. No, there shall be no pauper among you, meaning when you give, when you help others, make sure that there is no pauper among you, that you are not impoverishing yourself. So, the Talmud says, Shalcha kodem l'shal kol adam. Yours precedes that of all others. What happens if you actually divulge this information? As Rita has already noted, you are going to have a problem. Right? You can be sued by the company. You can lose your law license. Right? You violated the LSUC rules. So, the rule is in general, and so is ruled by various authorities in Jewish law, you don't endanger your own assets in order to save somebody else's financial assets. If it's financial on both sides, then you don't endanger your own position in order to help somebody else. So therefore, you may be justified in not informing them for that reason. Yes?
Is there any difference between the bankruptcy being caused by the process of proper business that just didn't work out and your knowledge that fraud is involved in the bankruptcy?
Say that again? Would you be justified?
The company's going bankrupt.
Yeah.
Right? Because it made bad business decisions and you're privy to that. That's what we've been talking about up to now. But what if it's going bankrupt because there's fraud involved and you're aware of it?
Right.
So,
right. So I specifically chose a case in which there's no wrongdoing because I wanted to show that this application without the crime. But we said in the beginning that in the event that a crime is taking place or has taken place, I am responsible to inform within the corporation, not within informing the public.
So your neighbor is still...
My neighbor still does not have the information. That's correct. So what we've said then is that in a case of bodily harm, of death, of serious emotional, psychological harm, then LSUC rules will permit me to tell. Jewish law will obligate me to tell. In a case of financial harm, LSUC rules will not permit me to tell. Jewish law, in a vacuum, would say, it appears, that you do tell. However, for at least four different reasons, you could argue that you don't inform. The reasons being, number one, because you are harming society by helping this individual. Number two, the person invested knowing that this was a risk. They accepted that term. Number three, by telling them I'm setting them up to do something illegal in order to save themselves. And number four, I'm endangering myself. And for a financial, to save someone else financially, that's not expected of me. And that brings me to my last case, which by now you can probably answer because of the last point I just made. But let's see it. As counsel in a case of medical malpractice, I become aware that a certain cardiac surgical team has a poor track record. A neighbor is planning on using them for her heart bypass surgery. I confer with my own counsel and learn that this does not rise to the level of risk permitting disclosure. However, I believe that I'm obligated to warn her, under the Jewish law requiring that I intervene to prevent harm to others. Do I inform her? What do you say? Get a second opinion. Tell her to get a second opinion. Possibly. So, the secular code will say, well, you already got your ruling. This doesn't fit the criteria for violating confidentiality. In terms of Jewish law, I am unsure. And this is why I am unsure. Number one, this inevitably, whenever you discuss this question of my obligation to Jewish law versus my obligation to a secular authority, people will always cite the principle I mentioned before of Dina Demachusa Dina, the law of the land is the law. And say, so obviously you have to follow it. But number one, if the law of the land puts me in direct conflict with my Jewish obligation, then the law of the land does not win. The law of the land wins in a vacuum. So the law of the land creates taxes. There's no law in Torah against taxes. So, okay, I'm obligated to pay taxes. The law of the land says, don't speed. So there's no mitzvah in the Torah of speed. So therefore, I'm obligated to obey the law of the land. They don't speed. But here, the law of the land says don't rescue people, and I have an obligation to rescue. The law of the land is void. That's number one. Number two, and more important, this isn't the law of the land. Right? I was very careful to stress that this is the law of the law society. It's not the law of the land. My rules of confidentiality are imposed upon me by the by industry regulations. So Rabbi Michael Broyd, in his book, The Pursuit of Justice in Jewish Law, notes this may not have the status of Dina Demachusa, of the law of the land, at all. So that's number one. Number two, what about the confidentiality rights of the surgical team? Well, we have a general principle that when someone seeks to harm somebody else, knowingly or unknowingly, they are called a rodef. They are called a pursuer. And I'm not only entitled, but obligated to stop them. So therefore, while I respect their confidentiality, if they are causing harm to somebody else, that may warrant overriding it. So why do I say I am unsure? I am unsure because in the case of financial harm, we said that you're not obligated to harm yourself in order to save somebody else in terms of the loss of their assets. What about a case of potential physical harm? It's cloudy. It's not clear to me whether I would be expected to lose my livelihood in order to warn somebody in this situation. That's unclear to me. And we have the point by Rabbi Cohen regarding the general welfare of society. So I think this is very tricky. It could be that somebody would resort to the method that was mentioned earlier of saying to them in the course of general conversation, you know, have you looked into them, without divulging anything. And again, I don't know if that's appropriate or not appropriate under LSUC regulations. This is certainly not a rule. I'm not offering any rulings on this, both in terms of secular law or in terms of Jewish law. But what I am saying is that it's a very interesting problem that a person could well be presented with. Okay, so to summarize what we said on the three vignettes, number one, in terms of confidentiality in case of physical or emotional harm, secular law says, or LSUC rules say you may. Jewish law says you must disclose. When it comes to financial harm, LSUC rules say do not divulge. Jewish law will say that that counts as one of the potential harms for which we say you are obligated to intervene and help others. However, it may not apply here for the reasons that we gave, whether because they personally accepted that this could happen, whether because it would harm society, whether because you'd be setting them up for wrongdoing, or whether because you're not expected to lose your assets to help someone else with theirs. And when Jewish law goes up against the rules of professional conduct, it is unclear whether you would be expected to lose your job, and everything that goes with it, the lawsuit and so on, in order to save somebody from this potential harm from the surgical team that has a bad record. Okay, that's basically what we wanted to accomplish this evening. Please make sure you signed in. I'd like to be able, at the least, to send out an email later notifying you of the site where this is found online once the recording is uploaded. and it's good for our records and credit and so on. Also, one last thing I will mention. On the table...